From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Folsom, California.
Noe Valley.
Village in the Park in Daly City.
Potrero Hill.
Glen Park.
South Beach.
I live in Bernal Heights.
Coming up, we're exploring the unique history of one Oakland neighborhood, Chinatown.
And we played in the streets a lot because, after all, I mean, I was born in the 30s. There weren't that many cars going up and down the streets. It was just a very peaceful childhood.
We'll hear about how urban renewal destroyed entire blocks.
Like, kind of like in the cartoons, isn't there a Bugs Bunny cartoon where the government comes in and says, we're putting the highway through where Bugs Bunny's hole is?
And how the community came together to form a new vision for Chinatown.
One thing that was our advantage is we didn't know how difficult it was to do this type of project. None of us had a track record at the time.
It's a special series produced with Mills College in Oakland, today on Cross Currents. Welcome to a special edition of Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Today we're taking a journey back through time to look at the history of one neighborhood in Oakland, Chinatown.
It was the most beautiful home on the block, and it was like you're entering into a wealthy home in China.
We'd go around and we would actually, like the Pied Piper, collect our Sunday school students.
Before World War II, Chinatown was a close-knit working-class community.
And we played in the streets a lot because, after all, I mean, I was born in the 30s. There weren't that many cars going up and down the streets. It was just a very peaceful childhood.
But urban renewal would alter the face of the neighborhood.
In my whole lifetime, I saw my mother cry twice. Once when her mother died, and the second time was when the bishop came to deconsecrate the space because it was going to be torn down and no longer a church.
Big development projects like the creation of BART and the Nimitz Freeway would dramatically change the neighborhood. This new phase of Chinatown began with the end of World War II.
2 million people screamed their elation at the end of the most devastating war in recorded history. For 24 hours, the celebration went on, and not for a minute did it lag. Victory had come. Old Glory waved over a happy land.
And a changing land. Returning vets were often seeking their fortunes outside of urban America.
The big development wave after the war is suburbanization. So vast growth of new housing tracts and new industry out in the suburbs.
UC Berkeley geographer Richard Walker says urban flight led to a decline in places like Chinatown.
So they're all concerned, how are we going to compete? How are we going to retain our downtown activities and our downtown land values, our downtown prosperity? And Chinatown, being right next to downtown, gets involved with that.
Professor Walker says Oakland's leaders had ambitious plans to clear out many of the neighborhoods surrounding the downtown business corridor, including Chinatown.
I mean, their most absurd plan was to tear down the entire downtown and rebuild it from scratch. I mean, you can't imagine the foolishness of this.
City officials were aided by national policy. The Federal Housing Acts of 1949 and 1954 provided funds for cities to clear out slums for redevelopment and make way for so-called progress.
Like so many people these days, we live in the suburbs, and Dave needs the car every day for business.
In 1950s America, the car was king.
3 weeks ago, we bought another Ford, the new low-price custom line Victoria. It's a whole new way of life.
A new way of life that meant building more freeways.
In this century, America has become a nation on wheels. We ride on wheels to work, to shop, to play, to go about any place we want to go. We depend on wheels to bring us the food we eat, the clothes we wear, the things we use. But when we depend on wheels, we depend also on highways and roads, and streets for the wheels to roll on. And therein lies the challenge, building highways and roads and streets fast enough to keep up with the need.
In Oakland, it was the 880 freeway, and it cut right through the heart of the city, including Chinatown. By the 1960s, the neighborhood was struggling. The declining population and urban renewal had left the neighborhood a mere shadow of itself. Chinatown's leaders were looking for a way to revitalize their community, and they turned to a surprising savior, the Redevelopment Agency. Tashina Maniak has that story.
Today, the Pacific Renaissance Plaza stands in the center of Oakland's Chinatown. It's a hub of community activity, with Mongolian dance classes, Korean drumming, and Chinese guzheng. It also boasts the busiest branch of the Oakland Public Library and houses 200 condos, 30 businesses, and 50 units of affordable housing. But it took 3 decades and a transformation of the neighborhood to realize this vision. In the 1960s, downtown Oakland had been more or less abandoned by investors. So when the city government once again declared Chinatown a redevelopment zone, the neighborhood's business and landowners were hungry for capital.
They're pretty desperate.
Richard Walker is a geography professor at UC Berkeley.
And their willingness to go along with this big government redevelopment program is a sign of their desperation. And so they accept this partnership with the government, with redevelopment agencies, because they see that as the only way is bringing vitality back.
According to lawyer Alan Yee, Chinatown's business leaders were so eager for development that they raised tens of thousands of dollars for a study to convince the city to invest in the neighborhood.
And so they actually pooled together their own funds and drafted a redevelopment plan for Chinatown.
It was the seed of what would eventually become the Pacific Renaissance Plaza. And part of the initial plan was realized. The city took a wrecking ball to an entire four-block area.
What the city did was they just tore everything down and left everything demolished, something which can't be done today anymore. So for a long period of time, these blocks were just demolished and left empty.
For about 2 decades. The demolition catalyzed the neighborhood to become actively involved. A Project Area Committee, or PAC, formed, and residents joined to make their voices heard in the planning process. But some of these constituents didn't share the business owner's vision for how redevelopment should proceed. Alan Yee remembers the meetings got pretty intense.
There was a lot of heated discussion among the various folks because of all the pressure, I think, was being placed on people at that point from the various forces that were operating. And so the meetings sometimes got very contentious, you know, and name-calling, whatever you want, you know.
The business sector of Chinatown wanted the space to be used for commercial purposes. Others wanted nonprofits and affordable housing to be part of the mix. Alan Yee belonged to the latter faction. One of his priorities was to replace the housing that had been lost to previous redevelopment projects.
Also to have a Asian library, and to have a cultural center that will benefit the community. Those were the ideas that people came up with in the 60s.
The discussion and debate continued through the 70s and 80s. Ultimately, Yee says the factions were able to resolve their differences and come up with a plan for the center that contained both businesses and cultural organizations.
And I think everybody learned from the fact that we needed to work together, that businesses and nonprofits, you know, basically have a lot in common and really need each other to survive. I think everybody learned from it, and Chinatown grew from that experience.
But there was another challenge the Pacific Renaissance Plaza would have to overcome. Geographer Richard Walker says Chinatown was becoming multicultural.
The most important change for Chinatown is going to be the immigration reform of 1965. And that's going to, of course, alter the face of California, the Bay Area, and Oakland completely.
The change relaxed strict immigration quotas that had been in effect essentially since the 1880s. As a result, new immigrants poured in from across Asia.
There's going to be arguments amongst all these people because Asian now is the, you know, this combination of many nationalities who historically don't necessarily get along at all.
Earlier plans for the Pacific Renaissance Plaza had called for a Chinese cultural center on site. Now, lawyer Alan Yee says there was talk of a Pan-Asian center.
A lot of people objected to it, and so there were some people who, for example, were on the original board that we established for the cultural center, felt that it should be Chinese, so they resigned.
Ultimately, though, the new inclusive plan won out.
I don't think anybody would disagree now that it should be an Asian cultural center.
It took more than 2 decades from the time the Pacific Renaissance Plaza was conceived until it was finally built. Nowadays, the center includes everything from a bubble tea shop to Philippine music lessons and Chinese folk dance classes. Alan Yee says the Pacific Renaissance Plaza was one of the first concrete expressions of Chinatown's new Pan-Asian identity.
It did cross ethnicity, it crossed class lines. I mean, the family associations were involved, businesses were involved, nonprofits were involved. So it really united the community for the first time.
The project didn't only change Chinatown. It also helped change how redevelopment works in Oakland. The top-down approach of urban renewal was replaced by one that brings more diverse neighborhood interests to the table. In Oakland, I'm Tashina Manyok for Cross Currents.
Listening to a special edition of KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're exploring the history of Oakland's Chinatown neighborhood. We've produced this special in association with Mills College in Oakland. And to help us on our audio tour, we're joined by journalist William Wong and Serena Chen, who came of age in Chinatown in the 60s and early 70s. They're going to help guide us here through the history of Oakland's Chinatown. Serena Chen wrote for East West Magazine, and she was also the host of Asians Now on Channel 2 from 1975 to 1987. So we just went through this sort of 30-year history of the development of the Pacific Renaissance Plaza to what it became in 1993. But I want to hear some of the backstory here. And one of the people that we weren't able to feature in this series because he's deceased is the Reverend Frank Marr. Serena, can you tell us about him?
Reverend Frank Marr was born way before his time and born exactly at the right time.
But he was a forward-thinking
minister. He was a totally forward-thinking minister who came here to the United States, went to ministry school. And when he got his, when he was hired with the, for the Chinese Presbyterian Church, he immediately just started to appeal to the people who were, who had been grown up here in the United States and watching and being watchers of the civil rights movement. And what we saw happening is that people who are now in their 60s and 70s who wanted to move Chinatown forward, who wanted to do the right thing, who wanted to serve the community in more than just a spiritual way, really gravitated toward Reverend Marr.
So Reverend Marr seemed to have this real social orientation, social conscience, even in the early 60s. I mean, he was really
Absolutely.
Way ahead of his time. Can you tell us about who he was?
Well, one of the first things he did was, which was easy in the sense of the fact that a couple of things coincided. One was that there was a growing federal support for housing for seniors, and the faith communities were the first ones to step up to the plate, as usual, where they see a need and they look to fill that need. And so basically, Reverend Marr helped form the committee to bring the first senior housing complex to Oakland Chinatown. And I think after that, he just kind of, you know, Reverend gone wild, he started really looking at all the needs that he saw growing in the community.
Was he viewed as controversial? How did the merchant class, Bill Wong, tell me?
We really did like the fact that he was moving forward because it was a forward-thinking Chinese-American man.
So he really appealed to the young people of the
community.
He would
appeal to the young and coming out of the civil rights era, coming out of Cal and other universities, children of the immigrants who first settled in Oakland.
And our next story is all about that. You're listening to a special edition of KALW News, produced with Mills College in Oakland. I'm Holly Kernan, and I'm here with William Wong, whom you just heard from, and Serena Chen. They're helping us take an audio tour of the history of Oakland's Chinatown. Before we go on to our next story, which is all about that next generation of activists, let's get a little bit more context. So in the late 60s and the 70s, Chinatown is changing. In fact, the U.S. is changing rapidly. In 1965, immigration reform opened the door to new immigration from places like Latin America and Asia. Let's hear from Professor Greg Mark about how that new immigration affected Chinatown.
As things moved into the 70s and 80s, it became much more visible and apparent. And, you know, not just the changing of organizations from kind of Chinese American to Asian American, but also the people. And one of the communities that, or immigrant groups that came in that have really kind of meshed together are the Vietnamese Americans. And, you know, who started coming in large numbers in the mid-70s, and then the boat people, the refugees. And so, you know, 1 million left around 1980. And again, some came to Oakland, and they were ethnic Chinese. So they kind of were able to kind of fit in. It was kind of compatible to who they were.
That's Professor Greg Mark, who grew up in Chinatown. UC Berkeley's Richard Walker says the new immigrants revived a decaying urban core.
Chinatown's changes so dramatically because you get these new waves of immigrants. It's going to revitalize it. It's going to expand it. It's going to bring in a whole group through Hong Kong, especially, but then later out of Vietnamese Chinese, after the fall of Saigon for the next 10 to 20 years, and Koreans, a new wave of Koreans. So you're going to get, there's going to be arguments amongst all these people because Asian now is the, you know, this combination of many nationalities who historically don't necessarily get along at all. And also, as it revitalizes, your old merchant class, of course, is going to grow, but there's going to be new money come in.
New money, but also new immigrants without resources like refugees. Historian Anna Neruda says this was the perfect mix to ignite a new generation of activists.
And also that meant that a lot of people worked really hard to create institutions to support those new immigrants.
And Lupe Casares has that story.
By the 1960s, Oakland's Chinatown had developed a strong middle class who could afford to send their children to college.
UC Berkeley was considered the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow for many families who grew up in the minority communities.
Ted Dang is a commercial real estate broker and developer. He grew up in Chinatown in the 1950s and 60s.
Our parents' generation really felt that a good education was a way to improve our life.
Dang started college in 1969, and he was the first person in his family to do so. He arrived at UC Berkeley to find a world that was totally different from the one he left behind in Chinatown.
It was a very tumultuous time. It was just at the tail end of the civil rights movement. It was this middle of the free speech movement and the beginning of the ethnic studies movement. And so while we were on campus, we learned that there were a lot more things happening than just what you can learn in the classroom.
Students were speaking out against the war in Vietnam, and they clashed with the police on a regular basis, like during this protest.
The cops are using billy clubs. The cops are using clubs.
The push for social change inspired Ted Dang and his peers. They saw a need for change in their own communities.
In the late 60s, there was a significant increase in immigration. And with immigration, you had a lot more people who had difficulty finding work, finding housing, finding services. You had the language problem. And a number of organizations formed in response to those needs.
But those organizations were scattered across Oakland. So the youth leaders decided to try to bring them together in one building in the center of Chinatown. Dang gathered some recent graduates from the architecture department and combined their expertise with his background as a business student.
We formed a grassroots organization that looked into developing real estate for the community.
They called their group the East Bay Asian Local Development Corporation, or EBALCI, and they decided to create their Asian Resource Center in a building near where Dang had grown up.
It was a vacant moving and storage building. It had been vacant for a number of years.
I walked past this building and it was all run down. But I said, wow, what an interesting looking building. Never thinking that I would end up being part of this.
That's Lynette Lee. Eventually, she would be the executive director of EBALCI for 33 years. But when I meet her in Chinatown, she explains in 1976, she didn't even know EBALCI existed yet.
I heard that they were having an open house for this building, this old warehouse, that they were going to raise money for to do a multi-service center. And so I came to the open house and got excited about it.
Lee had graduated from San Francisco State University in 1971 with a teaching credential and she had already gotten her feet wet as a community organizer. After graduating, she worked with a group called the Youth Council to help run an after-school program in Chinatown. One of her colleagues was Gregory Yi Mark.
When we did that, it was like a training. I mean, you know, it's not like you have years of training and you went to a graduate program that taught you how to become a community organizer and mobilize a community. We just did it.
Mark, who is now a professor of ethnic studies, says that training served Lynette Lee well later in her career.
We kind of made our contributions, the Youth Council, to EBALSI by, you know, really kind of training a whole cohort of people who became organizers, and Lynette is probably the best known of all of them.
When EBALSI first got started, Lynette Lee says the group had plenty of enthusiasm, but not much cash.
We had a little office here, and when it rained, the roof leaked, and we had to mop up, and there were broken windows that the pigeons would fly in and out of, and sometimes we'd have to go clean pigeon poop.
And it didn't get any easier. Tip Dang says funders were not always excited about the group's plan to build a social service center.
They thought we were just a bunch of kids playing around,
right,
and they didn't really believe that we could do it.
But the young activists were motivated by the dream of creating a new kind of Chinatown, one that would put the needs of the elderly and the poor on par with those of the more well-to-do.
One thing that was our advantage is we didn't know how difficult it was to do this type of project. None of us had a track record at the time.
But the group was scrappy and resourceful. Ted Ding knew how to write a lease. Another member, an architecture student, built a scale model of the community center out of cardboard to show to potential funders. Still, it took 8 years of fundraising, going to meetings, and presenting at community events before the group finally got the Asian Resource Center built. Not only did they get rid of the pigeons, but they also built a gallery and created a space for nonprofit agencies, businesses, and a clinic. But there was still more to do.
Completing that project, we soon recognized that our work should not stop there, that was just one building that could provide services and programs to one segment of the community that had a lot more needs.
Today, EBALSI has grown to manage more than 900 units of affordable housing, and it controls hundreds of millions of dollars of real estate. In fact, it's seen as a model around the nation. Gregory Yu Mark, who worked with Lynette Lee in the early days, says looking back, what they did was groundbreaking.
Here we had a group of 20-year-olds, literally, you know, and that we could have such an impact on the city of Oakland and the Asian American community.
Community organizing has changed a lot since those days, says Ted Dang.
Now, people actually get training in that business, and instead of volunteer students or young people that do the project, EBALSI, for example, has a staff of 80 people today, and many skilled people with higher degrees able to apply their knowledge to the needs in the community.
But it was EBALSI's idealistic work that paved the way for generations to come. In Oakland, I'm Lupe Casares for Cross Currents.
You're listening to a special edition of Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. We're exploring the history of one Oakland neighborhood, and that's Chinatown. This program was produced in association with Mills College in Oakland. I'm joined by journalist and author William Wong and Serena Chen. That story that we just heard is all about you, Serena. You were part of the early youth groups that would create the Asian Resource Center.
Absolutely. The Oakland, the East Bay Chinese Youth Council, which Greg Mark helped form, trained a group of us college students to become the team leaders for a bunch of high school students. And these were all immigrant high school kids, Chinese. And we coincided with the whole, after the Watts riot in Los Angeles, the federal government realized that summer was a bad time for riots. And so they basically started to pump money into the urban areas and said, make sure these kids don't have a riot this summer.
One of the things that struck me in listening to Ted Dang was that we didn't know how hard it was, and kind of the implication is if we had, we might not have really been able to accomplish all of this.
Well, we definitely had more enthusiasm and idealism than actual wisdom and knowledge and pragmatism. So basically, that's a good thing, because none of this would exist had we actually known what we were into.
That's Serena Chen. She grew up in Chinatown in the 60s and 70s, and she was a writer with East-West News. She also hosted the program on Channel 2 called Asians Now. William Wong is also with us. He's a journalist and author. And Bill, we're trying to tell a very dense story here in an abbreviated fashion, so obviously we're leaving some people out. You call these young 60s activists the 310 8th Street Gang. Tell us a little bit more about them.
Well, certainly from the story that Serena just told and the story about Ebolzi's founding, very important moment in China and contemporary Chinatown history. But that provided the building, 310 8th Street, provided a place for a number of different Chinese-American and Asian-American social service agencies to come together under one roof to dispense their services, among them being the Asian Health Services. That was
Sherry Hirota.
Sherry Hirota's group, which has its own building now, but it really started, it had its really growth start at 310 8th. The Asian Community Mental Health Services also is there. Filipinos for Affirmative Action is there. Asian Immigrant Women's Advocates is there. A number of other groups also are there. So what Ted and Serena and Greg did in the early to mid-70s was really a very important time, very significant.
One of the things that that some people told me about this whole era, this civil rights era, the 70s, this birth of a Pan-Asian identity, of identity politics and political power, one of the things that I think it was Alan Yee said was it was the first time that we really felt proud of our ethnic heritage. Mm. Can you speak to that, Serena?
Well, I think that, yes, the whole Black Power movement in Oakland basically said, I'm Black and I'm proud. And to give people some kind of feeling that they had a worth. And I think the Black Panther Party in its early stages really gave a lot of people a lot of self-worth and dignity. And basically, our groups actually met with the Black Panthers, and we actually, you know, worked together, and we formed coalitions with the Black Panthers, with the Filipinos, with the Latino groups. And one of the charms about Oakland is that there's not a critical mass of any one group, so that there's an imbalance in power. In San Francisco, Chinese were Chinese, and Japanese were Japanese, and Filipinos were Filipino. There was a really separation and a much longer history where people had issues with each other that did not manifest itself in Oakland.
And did you feel this unique sense of Oakland? You were at the Oakland Tribune during much of this time, Bill Wong.
Right. Just a word of perspective on the difference between what I would call the civil rights era, what Ted and Serena and Greg were doing out of the late 60s, early 70s, is that One reason to me of the difference between that generation and the elders who were mostly business owners before reflects the difference of place and time. They were, the older generation was under the strictures of the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act as it was practiced in Oakland's Chinatown in the early part of the 20th century. By the time the civil rights movement and all the countercultural stuff came along in the 60s, that really unleashed the newer generation, even though, the 70s folks were the children of this merchant class. So you have a natural both generational gap, experiential gap, and therefore, in order to move forward, I think what the folks did in the 60s and 70s was the right thing to do.
You're listening to a special edition of KALW News, produced with Mills College in Oakland. I'm Holly Kernan, and I'm joined by William Wong and Serena Chen, and we're taking an audio tour of Oakland's Chinatown neighborhood history. Earlier, we heard about the birth of the Pacific Renaissance Plaza in 1993. That seemed to be a real victory for Chinatown, and it signals the change from a Chinese-centric neighborhood to a more multicultural and Pan-Asian identity. But the battle wasn't over. In 2003, the Pacific Renaissance was again the center of a neighborhood fight. Melody Sage brings us that part of our story.
Just 10 years after the Pacific Renaissance Plaza opened in 1993, the low-income residential units there automatically converted to market rate. One of the tenants was 87-year-old Yan Hom. Her son, Art Hom, remembers how she got the news.
She got this notice in the mail that asked her that she had to either come up with about $300,000 to buy the apartment or move.
Occupants of the building's 50 subsidized units received eviction notices in April of 2003. At first, Yan Hom couldn't even understand the letter, which was written in English. Her son, Art, had to read it for her.
My mother felt hopeless and helpless, and we all felt pretty vulnerable. We realized at that time you were thinking you had no choices.
The eviction stunned the mostly elderly Chinese residents. They said no one had told them the units would stop being affordable. Still, Art Hom says most of them quietly began moving out.
Even at great financial sacrifice, and you know how disruptive this could be, the family life, what have you. Elders don't respond to this kind of disruption without affecting their health, so we had deaths, illnesses, relapses, and it was a very painful time.
But Yan Hom decided to fight her eviction. Art Hom says his mother was empowered by the battle.
My mother seemed to have found her voice and was able to say, "Oh, what's the next step? Let the sheriffs come?" The sheriffs would come next. She said, "Well, let them drag me out."
Yan Hom was conducting a live-in.
My mother was taking a huge risk. It's a huge cultural barrier where we are not allowed and we don't feel like we should allow people to know about our private affairs. And not having money and not having political power and having something is very disgraceful to people. And the culture is to keep it to yourself and quietly submit.
But Yan Hom had faced many displacements in her life. She left her home village in China when the Japanese invaded in World War II, and she fled to the U.S. in the politically turbulent years after the war. Art Hom says this time, his mom refused to go.
And so my mother was willing to stand up to it and maybe go to court, possibly even lose. But she made, was willing to make the sacrifice. So I was quite proud of her, and to this very day, I'm still very proud of her.
Another family was standing up to the evictions, too. Francis Chang's parents, who also lived at the Pacific Renaissance Plaza, were at a loss. Chang called lawyers, but they turned him away. Finally, desperate for help, he contacted the office of Congressmember Barbara Lee, where he was directed to the Berkeley Community Law Center. Art Hom says he and Chang called the center.
And we realized that we actually have more options than we imagined. And one was to that we could actually try to fight the eviction. And of course, and we also felt like that was a choice, but can't do it alone.
The local community group, CJWP, or Moving Forward for Peace, joined the fight too. Volunteers went door to door at the Pacific Renaissance Plaza trying to organize tenants to resist the eviction. Half a dozen chose to stay, forming a small but determined tenants' rights group. And with the help of the City of Oakland, they filed a lawsuit against the Pacific Renaissance developer, Lawrence Chan. The plaza had been built with public money, so advocates argued that the developer had an obligation to the community. And as the fight wore on, an increasingly diverse and intergenerational group of protesters took up the cause. Hom says his mother was celebrated as a hero.
Now, this is quite unusual for an 80-some-year-old woman who all her life has been pretty much not have any political power at all.
Hom remembers bringing his mother to one of the many hearings at City Hall.
Yeah, and I'm just wheeling my mom up in a wheelchair and see people surrounding her from the outside as we enter the meeting hall, holding signs and doing street theater and doing renditions of my mom's life experience in a mural. Yeah, it was a quite inspirational experience to be, and actually, we're no longer isolated anymore, and we had a sense of community and a sense of belonging, and feeling heard, validated, understood.
In 2007, they settled out of court. The developer turned over the low-income units to the nonprofit Ibaldzi, ensuring that they would remain below market rate and affordable for future residents. Art and Yan Hom had succeeded. But Yen Hom didn't live to see her victory. She died a year and a half into the lawsuit. Art Hom says the fight gave his mother a sense of purpose at the end of her life.
She was able to join us and make a stand for herself, and I think she felt invigorated by that. No longer the helpless victim. The principles that we fought for are still alive. And that, yes, one 80-some-year-old woman can make a difference, but it takes a whole community organization around it and many, many people to sacrifice a lot of time and energy to stand up for what we believe and work together.
Hom says his mother helped inspire a generation of activists, and he says he hopes that legacy of empowerment endures. In Oakland, I'm Melody Sage for Cross Currents.
You're listening to a special edition of Cross Currents from KLW News, produced with Mills College in Oakland. We're exploring the history of one neighborhood, Chinatown. I'm Holly Kernan, and I'm joined by journalist and author William Wong and Serena Chen. Serena reported on all of these events for East West News. And Serena, I understand that your articles were actually used to document some of the promises that the developer had originally made, and they were one of the reasons that this lawsuit was settled.
It just basically shows this whole, you know, battle with the developer trying to get as much as he can, and with the community saying, wait a minute, you're getting a much lower rate per square foot to buy this property, to develop it. What you have to do is give back to the community. And the give backs to the community, which were a fair exchange, were the library, the community center, and the 50 units of affordable housing. The fact that he did not fulfill his side of the bargain for the 50 units of affordable housing in the loans and the other deals that they had made made it impossible for him to sell the units at market rate at the time that he wanted to and evict the tenants.
What they did was they did a deal so that Ibaldi took over ownership of those condos and was allowed to keep them for low income.
Yeah, that was the resolution. Right.
That was the resolution. Yeah. The other issue that was going on was that the owner of the complex was being called home to Hong Kong. And so his father wanted to clean up anything that was going on with the properties in the United States and get his son home. So basically, they went into this deal.
And that helps us segue into our next story. And it has to do with the fear that Hong Kong was going to revert to mainland China rule and that that might have adverse economic effects. Let's hear from Professor Greg Mark, who talks about this new influx of money from Hong Kong.
During about 82, 83, you know, there was this huge concern, like in Hong Kong, about the discussions that would lead up to 1997 and the turnover of Hong Kong to China. And so a lot of people in Hong Kong were concerned about, oh my gosh, what's going to happen when it turns communist? You know, and so what people did is people started to leave and set up residency in San Francisco, Oakland, Vancouver, Toronto, Sydney, you know, all over the world, and try to establish dual residency in case things didn't work out in Hong Kong, that they had a place to go with their families. But also at the same time meant their money. So billions of dollars came out of like Hong Kong in preparation for this. And I think that helped to spur redevelopment, the economic development of many of these Chinatowns.
And with a lot of this immigration and money that was pouring in from Hong Kong, there were a lot of big development plans, many of which didn't actually materialize. Let's hear from UC Berkeley's Richard Walker.
So there was a big developer in Hong Kong who'd become filthy rich on the growth, post-war growth of Hong Kong, which was the first part of China to really boom. And so he wanted to invest some of his money in Oakland's Chinatown. He was going to partner with some local investors in this Hong Kong USA. That's why I got the name. There at the corner of Broadway and 11th. And it was supposed to be a 60-story skyscraper. This guy had a lot of surplus money and a lot of ambition in this bubble. But in the meantime, before they could ever build this, the real estate bubble in Hong Kong in the early 70s collapsed. And the rich fellow in Hong Kong, I don't remember his name now, ended up in a scandal. Apparently, he had been avoiding taxes. And the Brits, who still controlled Hong Kong, sent some kind of an assessor, a tax evaluator, out to speak with this man, who ended up floating face down in Hong Kong Harbor. And the big investor ended up going to jail for the rest of his life.
That's UC Professor Richard Walker, and you're listening to a special edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. We're exploring the unique history of Oakland's Chinatown. I'm Holly Kernan, and I'm joined by William Wong, who's a journalist and an author. And you were going to actually tell us the rest of that story.
Well, I was the business editor at the Oakland Tribune from late 79 to the summer of 81. And it was during that period where this rich Hong Kong developer that Professor Walker refers to.
And you know the actual name, he didn't remember.
Yeah, Y.T. Chow, C-H-O-U is the last name as I remember it, emerged as one of the saviors of Chinatown, downtown Oakland. And my memory was that he had plans for an 80-story tower, not the 60, but 60, 80, what's the difference in a way? There was a great deal of excitement among the city leadership about this guy coming in, and there was probably some excitement in Chinatown, too, about that. And I remember sending a reporter, that's when the Tribune had a little money, sending a reporter to Hong Kong to chase him down or to chase the story down. And it, eventually, it's true, as Professor Walker talked, This Mr. Chow got into some real trouble in Hong Kong. The deal never came across. So these grand plans are part of the perspective, as Greg Mark remarked, that there was a lot of desire to get money out of Hong Kong at the time. So to me, the lesson here is that Oakland's Chinatown isn't isolated by any means. It is part of this great geo-economic, geopolitical picture that is forever changing.
And that is a bit of a mixed bag. We're also joined by Serena Chen, who was reporting on all of this for East West News, along with Channel 2, where she was the host of Asians Now. Serena, what do you remember about some of this Hong Kong money? You told us earlier, off mic, a little story about a suitcase.
Yes, the mayor at that time was Lionel Wilson. And basically, he was making
Oakland's
a lot
of, first black mayor, by the way.
He was making a lot of trips to Hong Kong. And at one trip, that developer gave him a suitcase of $1 million in cash and said, here, you know, make sure that your people get employed and, you know, take care. You know, it was coached in a positive way, but it basically was, you know, here, make this happen.
Here's a bribe.
No one ever said that word. But basically, because we were the activists in the community, we really felt that some of that money should go to employment development. It should go to building a foundation for the community so that agencies could have seed money, things like that. So we knew about the money, and we wanted to make sure the community got a share of it.
Was there a little bit of naivete in terms of the expectations of what money could come from Hong Kong and, you know?
I think that the city officials were not really very sophisticated about dealing with international, multinational companies who are used to giving money away.
And let's hear again from UC Berkeley's Richard Walker.
Well, the craziest plan was the one to tear all of downtown down and start over again. The original city center plan was much larger. Again, in Chinatown, the craziest one was a Hong Kong, USA, a 60-story skyscraper. I mean, how they could imagine that Oakland could sustain a 60-story skyscraper. I mean, it really was delusional.
All right, so delusional, is that a fair assessment, William Wong?
I think it is in retrospect, of course, because that was a time when Chinatown, while it was coming back, but it was also absorbing all these new immigrants. There was a new contingent of Chinese Vietnamese coming in, and there was all this civil rights activism that was happening at that time. And Serena's right, the city really wasn't used to or didn't have the wherewithal to deal with the potential of multi-millions of dollars coming in from Asia. So the it was kind of a clash of expectations in a way, and capacity as well. So it was delusional.
Well, that leads us into our next story, because along with the money from Hong Kong came some of the Asian gangs. And that's the subject of our next story from the early 1980s. It's about an immigrant from Hong Kong who would change community police relations. Let's hear from reporter Sina Woodson.
See, like, this place has been here forever.
Yeah. I'm walking around Chinatown with Harry Hu. He's the former gang unit leader for the Oakland Police Department. He's tall and burly, and although he recently retired from the force, he still wears his gun and badge proudly on his belt. He's taking me on the foot patrol route he followed every day in the early 1980s. As he strolls down 8th Street, most people seem to recognize him. Some wave, and others stop to chat.
I just hang out this place almost every day.
Now he don't walk in Chinatown anymore.
People are friendly now. But when Hu was first assigned here, they didn't speak to him so freely.
People in Chinatown were very skeptical because they never really had any, you know, personal interaction with the police.
Hu says recent immigrants in particular had misgivings.
They come from war-torn countries. They come from third world where the police was not there to protect the citizens. And often they were corrupted. So they don't trust the police.
That made it hard to solve crimes in Oakland's Chinatown, so the OPD hired Harry Hu in 1981. He was the first bilingual Asian American officer in the department. He spoke Cantonese, Mandarin, and Toisinese, but Hu says because of his size, lots of people assumed he wasn't Chinese, and they didn't realize he could understand them.
And people were just talking as I was walking down the street and say, man, now they put a Hawaiian here, you know, and not knowing that I was Chinese.
But eventually, people in Chinatown figured it out and started talking to Hu. It took about 6 months, but pretty soon, he says informants were coming to him. Some residents would even wait for Hu to come back from vacation to report urgent matters, such as robberies. In return for the information, he kept residents informed about law enforcement activities. Hu's walking partner in the early 80s was Rodney G.
Just them getting that information and feedback and from Harry made them feel better. I could see that. And to feel better that we're involved, really involved.
With the help of Chinatown residents and merchants, Hu and G learned everyone's given names and nicknames and kept their pictures on file. Hu even knew many of the alleged criminals personally. In one major extortion incident, Hu says the entire case broke because of a nickname.
Because the one of the suspects demanding the extortion money gave a nickname was Rice Boy. And I remember who Rice Boy was because I just stopped him like 2 weeks prior to that incident. I said, I know Rice Boy.
That kind of success led to Harry Hu's transfer to the intelligence unit in 1989. At the time, Asian organized crime was on the rise. Newspapers were constantly reporting on the growing gang phenomenon, like in these articles from the Washington Post in 1984.
Fear of the 1997 Chinese takeover of Hong Kong has sent a flood of Asian investment into Chinese-American communities, creating new opportunities for both legitimate businesses and a new breed of criminal gangs.
A loose-knit Asian mafia with criminal operations in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and more than a dozen North American cities is responsible for a fifth of the heroin imported into the United States. Attorney General William French Smith said the Chinese triad societies are part of new crime cartels emerging in the Far East and spreading to the West.
Harry Hu was working to stop those cartels. As an officer in the OPD's intelligence unit, he started working on the gang problem. And in 1991, Hu became part of Oakland's first gang unit.
And I was there by myself with my partner, two people, gang unit for the whole city of Oakland. And we were busy.
Hu says one gang in particular that had formed in Oakland, called Wah Hop Toe, began to pose a major threat to the Chinatown community. In 1991, the gang conducted door-to-door extortions all over the neighborhood, as well as in San Francisco. Soon, the operation extended to other parts of the United States and China. Harry Hu says that's when the FBI got involved.
And we were deputized as federal agents for the FBI, so we cross-designated. We could literally go anywhere, you know, within U.S., and we have authority as a federal agent.
Hu says over time, the gang unit virtually eliminated organized crime in Chinatown. Officer Rodney G says the key was knowing the criminals and the neighborhood in which they operated.
They get away with stuff when they have they're anonymous. You know, you don't know who they are, but when you know them before they even commit the crime, boy, you got a big jump on them.
So, this was the shop that Mr. Jin used to own.
Who says he doesn't see many young people hanging out in Chinatown anymore? He thinks residents and merchants feel safe to a certain extent, but admits crime is still an issue.
But it's not blatantly and right in front of you and causing a lot of problems for the community in Chinatown and threatening, the well-being of Chinatown.
According to Hu, some of the men who used to threaten Chinatown have now turned their lives around.
They're now family men. They have business established. Yeah, they will still see each other, out in the street and talk about the old days, and they say how stupid they were before,
Hu retired from the Oakland Police Department in 2005, but the gang unit he helped build is still in operation. These days, Hu works as an inspector in the Alameda County DA's office, and he stays in touch with the Chinatown community.
I still participate in a lot of their functions. Yeah, of course, folks are a lot older now.
Today's Chinatown is a vibrant place with markets and shoppers and crowded sidewalks. Harry Hu helped make it a safer place and broke the barrier between police and community. Now that's a goal all over the country, but in Hu's day, it was something extraordinary. In Oakland, I'm Sina Woodson for Cross Currents.
You've been listening to a special report exploring the history of one Bay Area neighborhood, Chinatown in Oakland. Tune in tomorrow when our series continues.
And Oakland Chinatown is simply the human form of Mount St. Helens, in the sense that despite everything, despite all predictions, it just keeps coming back to life.
You'll also hear the story of one woman who's made it her goal to bridge the generation gap.
I think everyone thinks I'm crazy to be working here. Most people my age would be rather traveling or hanging out with other old people. But to me, I feel my calling is to be here with the teens. And I have no interest in hanging out with a bunch of old people.
Plus, Tai Chi takes over an abandoned plaza. And what should we do with the three-block area that is again slated for redevelopment?
Why not take our new smart growth thinking? Then you have a perfect place to really take what we've learned from our past mistakes and rebuild a community.
That's tomorrow at 5 when our series on Chinatown continues. You've been listening to a special edition of KALW News, produced with Mills College in Oakland. We've been exploring the history of Oakland's Chinatown. You can hear all of the stories in our series at klwnews.org, and we invite you to add your memories from Oakland's Chinatown as well. This series was edited by Zoe Corneli and produced by Chris Hoff. We had help from Melanie Young, Thea Croman, Erica Mu, and Martina Castro. Special thanks to William Wong and Serena Chen for accompanying us on this audio tour. We're also grateful to Roy Chan and Anne Huang for their production assistance. The reporters for this series are Lupe Caceres, Jennifer Courtney, Lindsay Lee Keel, Tashina Maniak, Annabelle Peterson, Morgan Ross, Melody Sage, Priscilla Wilson, and Sina Woodson. All of them are students at Mills College in Oakland. Our managing editor is Ben Trefney. Also thanks to Sarah Geis and StoryCorps for their help with this series. You can find out more about sharing your stories through StoryCorps and the Asian Cultural Center's memory map by going to klwnews.org. Thanks for joining us on this audio tour of Oakland's Chinatown. For Mills College and KALW Public Radio, I'm Holly Kernan.